BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
You're listening to A Point of View, a personal essay from a leading writer. Here's Sarah Wheeler.
My shelves are crowded with guidebooks, plenty of them older than I am. I keep them long after their restaurants have gone out of business and hunt down second-hand specimens to fill geographical gaps. Out-of-date guides offer valuable perspective. How people like us went about things 10 years ago, or 50, or 100. The past being a foreign country, in my battered volumes, pages stained with beverages of yore, I get to see how they did things differently there. My adult children treat this with the contempt they reserve for most things I do. When one of them was about to visit Berlin recently, I piped up, "I'll fetch you a guidebook." "Knowing you," he replied with a grimace when I returned with the volume in my hand, "it will have been written before the wall came down." "I'm pleased to say," I replied, "it was written before the wall went up." Like a telescope onto the past, the books reveal how my predecessors prepared for their big adventure. First, what to pack. Murray's 1848 handbook to Italy considers a portable India rubber bath essential. A decade later, the same firm's Egypt suggests that an iron bedstead might come in handy. One should also pack flags for the boat on the Nile, a small pulley and rope to get them aloft, and a fireplace. I can imagine the scenes at the Ryanair check-in desk. Beds and bedsteads often crop up once the Victorian tourist arrives at her destination. You might be used to forking out extra for the minibar, but according to Murray, on the journey from Cairo to Suez, the use of a bed must be paid in full separately, according to tariff. In the Greek countryside, furthermore, one should always accept the offer of a billiard table to sleep on, as the traveller will thereby have a better chance of escape from vermin. The chief question I ask the old guides is whether the spirit of a place, the genius loci, can survive the upheaval of the years. Is the spirit of place immutable, or can it change? Every guide to Manhattan published before 1960 talks of the river light infusing the crosstown streets, an apparently wondrous luminosity long extinguished in a forest of skyscrapers. And where are the furriers around Canal Street, or the opium dens of Mott and Pell? The books record the soft tissue of history, the perishable bits. Much has bested time. After I crossed into Mexico at the Ote border post and hammered down the long finger of Baja California on Highway 1, past the strung-out casinos and the lurid resorts, and turned left at San Telmo into the Cordillera, the high chaparral of the old guidebooks was there to greet me, and at Rancho Melling, cattlemen sloped in for lunch at the sound of a handbell, tossing identical straw hats onto the end of the refectory table. Higher up, on the Picacho del Diablo, you can still view the Sea of Cortez and the Pacific from the same spot. A year ago, leaving the traffic jams of Muscat with a 19th-century Baedeker under my arm, old Oman reasserted itself in the red sandstone back streets of Nizwa to the south of the capital, just as Chapter 10 describes. In Colombia, I left the hellhole of Cartagena, and in a few hours was being poled across the fabled Magdalena River from Mompox to El Palomar. The 15-metre boat might be metal now, but the steamy heat was the same as it has been since before the conquistadors sent prototype guidebooks home, and so were the sheaves of green bananas stowed at the prow. In the Heavenly Federal Writers Project Guides to American States, published as part of Roosevelt's New Deal to create jobs for writers, Rachel Reeves take note, the past springs to life in ways the tourists can still experience two generations on. The 1939 Kentucky, A Guide to the Bluegrass State, describes fording the Kentucky River by ferry where it cuts Tate's Creek Road south of Lexington. You still can, and I did. The Valley View Ferry, still free of charge, still rudderless and still cable-guided, is one of the few remaining river ferries in the US. In the places I have mentioned, as in the out-of-date guidebooks, you see the past without the modern stuff in it. I don't wish to romanticise the old days anywhere. Children aren't dying of cholera in Tijuana in the 21st century, and Oman's erstwhile 90% literacy rate has been transformed. Today, nearly every Omani knows how to read. But I find it heartening to witness any landscape that outlives the horrors of the present, even if only in a limited way. Telephone numbers might be obsolete in a guidebook, but its pages, sometimes, confirm an ineffable spirit, resistant to the depredations of both time and development. In the poem Not in Baedeker, W. H. Auden shows people going about emotionally fulfilled lives in a depleted landscape far from the shimmering highlights of the tourist itinerary. The title suggests a guidebook's innate superficiality, but actually, quite a lot of the humanity Auden conjures does appear in Baedeker, if you persist with the infernally small print. Last spring I went to Trieste with a guidebook published at a time when the city was not even part of Italy. The volume mentions the bad-tempered patron of waterfront trattorias at Muggia across the bay, shooing cats at dinner time. Sure enough, over at Muggia, the descendants of the cats rubbed our legs when the fish came out, and the descendants of the patron chased them vigorously away. Daily life in all its trivial detail slips the shackles of time. The superiority of tone of the old volumes, problems with servants and so on, gives way as the guidebook itself evolves. Blue guides, shell guides, dear old Pevsner for British buildings. One observes the traveller moving quietly into the modern era. The snobbery and prejudice of the grand tour merchants mutates into the inverse snobbery of the budget-conscious guide. By the 1980s, if you spent more than a pound a night on accommodation, you were part of the people-eating capitalist monster. I remember going all the way down Chile with a South American handbook which graded accommodation by price from A to F, and backpackers vied to find the Fs. Scabies was a badge of honour. But by sending us all abroad, has the guidebook written itself out of a job? Has it reached the status of the West African black rhinoceros, which the first tourists helped hunt to extinction? This week it was announced that the phrase anti-tourism has made its debut in Collins' dictionary. It means opposition to or action against large-scale tourism. When I wrote my first book, it was good to travel, even morally good, as it signalled that perhaps you weren't a narrow-minded little Englander. But the three horsewomen of the apocalypse write the contemporary agenda: pandemics, cultural appropriation, and the vital need to prioritise the environment. But still we go in that small-scale way that has not yet reached the dictionary. Next week I'm off to the Basque country, so I'm deep into a 1913 Spain and Portugal handbook for travellers. On the upside, table wine, vino corriente, is seldom charged for. I'm investigating in particular detours from Bilbao. According to the guide, all mountain-girt plains and alpargatas, wonderfully comfortable hemp shoes on sale in the markets. Halfway down a page, I stopped as abruptly as the narrow-gauge train which ran then from Amorebieta to Pedernales, 3 pesos first class. A small town, reads the guide gaily, of 3,250, splendidly situated on the Mundaca, the seat of the Diet of Vizcaya, in which the deputies met in front of the Casa de Juntas under a spreading oak tree. This was Guernica. I was looking through the telescope the other way round now, from the end where women shooed cats before Civil War bombs fell in Guernica, and Picasso painted not the old oak tree, but a gored horse, a dismembered soldier, and a dead baby, all the pity of war in one long scream. Those horrors lay ahead for the men and women and children of Guernica in 1913, and the future was a land without guidebooks, the most foreign country of all.
Hello, I'm India Axon, and I just want to quickly talk to you about witches. In this series from BBC Radio 4, simply titled Witch, I'm going to explore the meaning of the word today. It is a twisting, turning rabbit warren of a world, full of forgotten connections to land and to power, lost graves, stolen words, and indelible marks on the world. Because the story of the witch is actually the story of us all. Come and find out why on Witch with me, Indira Rackerson. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.